Ireland's win against Finland in the Women's World Cup soccer qualifier yesterday is celebrated in photographs on three front pages. Happy women in green are pictured in the Irish Examiner, Irish Independent and Irish Times. By contrast, the face of John Traynor, who died in the UK on Sunday, appears on three other front pages. He is described in the Irish Daily Star as an infamous mobster. He was evil John Gilligan's former right-hand man, according to the Irish Daily Mirror. The Irish Sun says Traynor was centrally involved in the planning of the murder of the Sunday Independent reporter Veronica Guerin. The three papers' headline writers agree on their verdict. Blood on his hands, say the Sun and Mirror. He got away with murder, says the Star. The other papers look elsewhere for their lead stories. The Independent reports that first-time buyers are being squeezed out of the market for new homes, with cash-rich purchasers and cuckoo funds snapping up half the available stock. Just 24 hours after the publication of its plan to cut carbon emissions by 51% in the next decade, the government has been warned that it does not go far enough, so says the Examiner. A United Nations Environment Programme report demands emissions reductions of at least 55%, and Ireland's carbon budgets published on Monday fall short of that, the paper says. That UN report is the main story for the Mail as well. The headline writer sums up its message, "Wake up or face climate catastrophe." A stark warning is mentioned in the Times lead headline, but it's about the trajectory of COVID-19, and it was given in a presentation to a cabinet subcommittee by the Minister for Health, Stephen Donnelly. Members were told that cases were as high now as at any point apart from the peak of the January wave, and there were no guarantees that a coming peak in infection would rapidly fall away in the run-in to Christmas. On the other hand, the Examiner reports that the Cabinet Subcommittee on COVID-19 heard that a high level of compliance in the enforcement of COVID certificates was found last weekend in venues across the country. For a personal response to the matter, there is a column in the Times by Roisin Ingle. She says her unvaccinated relative who lives abroad is thinking of coming home for Christmas and has asked to stay with her. She says she is open to having him stay because even if I disagree with him, I care about him and respect his decision not to get vaccinated. But after some discussion with her about what would be involved in a visit here, between vaccine certs and other people reluctant to have him over, the unvaccinated relative is now considering other options for Christmas. He might spend it in Morocco or Sri Lanka instead. "You're probably better off," Ingle tells him. "I think you might be right," he says.
Rising COVID infections and continuing increases in hospitalisation, environmental issues and publication of carbon budgets to tackle Ireland's greenhouse gas emissions, and new ticketing arrangements for nightclub and music venues, all issues for ministers attending this morning's cabinet meeting. The Irish Times political reporter Jack Horgan-Jones is on the line. And Jack, Dáil Éireann Seanad not sitting this week, but the CMO's latest warning and worries about rising COVID numbers will surely be in the front of the minds of ministers as they gather for this cabinet meeting.
Yes, Mary, there was a meeting last night of the cabinet's COVID subcommittee, which is senior ministers, the HSE, and also has input from NPHET, and they were given a fairly stark warning about the trajectory of COVID-19. Now, I think it's important to note that they're not being told it's about to spiral out of all control and reach levels like we saw back in January of this year, but they are being told that it could grow as high as 4,000 or 5,000 cases a day. There could be a peak of 800 to 1,000 people in hospital and between 150 people and 200 in ICU associated with those hospitalizations. And I think what's more important and what's new here is perhaps what will happen after that peak. We've become used to peaks of COVID infection falling away relatively quickly as lockdown measures kick in. Now, there were no discussions of new restriction measures last night, so there will be an element of you know, living with COVID that we haven't gone through before, but that raises the question of how quickly that peak may fall away, and it may not be that precipitous fall they were told last night that we're used to, and it may be something that either plateaus or declines much more slowly on the run into Christmas, which presents a whole new host of challenges for the health service as it deals with non-COVID care and other winter ailments as well.
Will they be worried too, Jack, about the new levels of social mixing that we had over the bank holiday weekend and how that's now going to affect infection numbers in 2 or 3 weeks' time? Will they want to factor that into their planning?
I think undoubtedly that's one of the confounding factors associated with this wave of COVID infection. There's a lot of novelty here at work, and as you correctly say, just as cases go up, we're in fact allowing people to mix more and mix in settings that haven't been open since March or February of 2020. The most obvious example being the nighttime economy and nightclubs, which are reopening and reopened last weekend. There's other new issues like how variants play out, how vaccine immunity interacts with infection acquired immunity, which just make things quite difficult to predict. And that was another message that came across fairly loud and clear for that briefing of senior ministers yesterday evening.
And I see Minister Varadkar is being quoted this morning in your own newspaper and elsewhere, talking about anticipating teething problems in the implementation of this new ticketing arrangement for nightclubs and late night venues. Is that an understatement from him? They appear to be very unhappy.
I think certainly those representative groups that met with government officials yesterday would argue that it's a gross understatement. All right, there were angry confrontations, as I understand it, between representative groups and officials from the Department of Culture and the Department of Enterprise, who briefed them yesterday on this new and controversial plan that they're going to be asked to set up effectively ticketing systems. People will have to have a ticket an hour before attending an event, and they're saying that not only does that raise a whole host of implementation issues, which are new and difficult for many of them to navigate, but it's also being landed on them at extremely short notice. They're expecting the regulations to come into force later on this week, and that they'll be asked to implement them almost immediately. Now, talking to people in government last night, I detected a bit of a tin ear for these concerns. There's, I don't think, any indication that the sector is going to be given any special treatment, and government sources were pointing to the fact that other sectors such as indoor dining have previously been asked to reopen with special terms and conditions, COVID cert, social distancing attached. So there may be an element of being asked to grin and bear it, or as one source put it to me last night, the sector should read the room a little bit. There are rising rates of COVID infection, and reopening is proceeding notwithstanding that. So I'm not sure that they're going to be pushing against an open door with their concerns.
And does it appear that early feedback from the weekend shows that there's been high levels of compliance with the whole COVID certification for entry into clubs?
That is something that the Cabinet subcommittee was told. Apparently, they were told that there was a push over the bank holiday weekend by the Health and Safety Authority, the HSE, and inspectors from the Private Security Authority to look at issues around compliance with the COVID cert. There have been a lot of discussion, a lot of anecdotal evidence last week that, you know, compliance here was slipping, and I'm sure many of your listeners will have gone into restaurants and not been asked for their COVID cert. So I think that this enforcement push went hand in glove with that, and there aren't any hard stats being circulated, mm-hmm. but apparently ministers were told that there was a high degree of compliance.
The early feedback on that. This is a big few months for Eamon Ryan, the minister now, with piloting through these carbon budgets. And he's also going to have to introduce the sectoral emissions ceilings for all the different sectors. How much resistance is he going to meet, and will it start around that cabinet table this morning?
Well, to the best of my knowledge, there's no, there's nothing significant regarding the sectoral levels going to cabinet this morning. There are a couple of climate-linked items around a report from the National Economic and Social Council and a new auction process for the developers of renewable energy projects. But that doesn't mean that, you know, the difficult battles that are undoubtedly ahead for the government on this won't come up in conversation around the cabinet table. In fact, I'd be surprised if they didn't. And the most acute of these will, of course, be between Eamon Ryan's department and the Department of Agriculture run by Fianna Fáil's Charlie McConlogue, where it seems there is a confrontation between the climate reality around the level of emissions that is being produced from the sector and the political imperative, which has traditionally been to keep growing the sector on the same footing Those two things, that circle can't be squared. And I think that, you know, that is something that the government is going to have to confront. Okay. A colleague of mine, Cormac McQuinn, was talking to backbenchers last night. There does seem to be a way out of this. You know, it just seems to involve writing large checks for farmers who may be affected. And that's the signals, I think, coming from the backbenchers. So expect a round of horse trading between backbenchers, ministers and sectoral interest groups in the days and weeks ahead.
Weeks to come. All right. Irish Times political reporter Jack Horgan-Jones. COVID-19 infections are on the rise again in Europe, with Russia, Ukraine and Romania registering the highest fatalities. And China has placed a city of 4 million under lockdown in an attempt to stamp out a domestic coronavirus outbreak. As the rest of the world opens up and tries to find ways to live with the virus, China has maintained a zero COVID approach that has included harsh local lockdowns imposed sometimes over just a handful of cases. Our reporter Yvonne Murray joins me now from Taiwan. Yvonne, first to this lockdown in Lanzhou, what can you tell us about that?
As you say, this was just after a handful of cases, just six cases reported in a population of 4 million people. The whole city is in lockdown. This is not the first time we've seen this. This is what China does every time there are a few cases reported. And I think this outbreak, which began a couple of weeks ago, seems to have spread to 11 other provinces. Now, to put it in perspective, we're talking about roughly 200 cases over that time in a population of 1.4 billion people. So very strict measures. As soon as there's one case reported, one case for the Chinese authorities is just too much. And we're seeing stay-at-home orders issued in various districts in Beijing, major events cancelled, like the Beijing Marathon, which was due to take place next weekend. And as you say, it's this zero tolerance approach that we've seen time after time with these outbreaks in China, which have continued periodically. And it is expected that they will get this outbreak under control in the same way they have done in all the previous cases.
We'll talk, Yvonne, in a moment about the economic impact of these of the zero COVID policy and these lockdowns. But what about the personal impact on citizens? What about the impact on schools and colleges and daily life?
This is something on which there's very little data coming out of China. What we have is really anecdotal, because overall, the COVID policy in China is a source of enormous national pride, especially when they look across the world and they see places like the UK and the US that are really struggling with massive outbreaks. They feel pleased, for the most part, that they live in a country where they don't have to worry about contracting it. So there's a huge amount of support for government policy, harsh as it is. Having said that, there's as a result of that, there's very little information on the impact on people's personal well-being, on their mental health, on what it's done to communities. And I think that is something that people will be interested in finding out in the aftermath. But at the moment, very little to go on.
And just to come to vaccination, what's the vaccination policy? Is it mandatory?
The vaccination policy is not mandatory yet. However, it's very difficult to live in China without being vaccinated. They're now at quite a high vaccination rate, roughly 76% of the population. They've rolled out the vaccine to the over 11s, now going to extend it to 3-year-olds and above. These are only the Chinese vaccines that are allowed in China, Sinopharm and Sinovac. Not mandatory, but if you want to, say, go into a restaurant, if you want to go into a public place, then you have to show on your mobile phone that you have a clean health app and a vaccination record. So not mandatory, but effectively you have to have it really to operate.
And to that economic impact, I mean, can you close down a society for so long without having a level of economic impact now?
The level of economic impact has been significant, but China, it's still making everything for the rest of the world. So, the shipments out of China, although there have been disruptions in the supply chains, are continuing, and that has helped to prop up the economy. Having said that, communities localities have been deeply affected by these rolling lockdowns. And the problem is you never know when the next one is going to come. So a lot of closures, a lot of of shop closures, a lot of restaurant closures, and that is beginning to have an impact. Plus, we've seen other events in China this year, like the crisis in the property market, which are having an impact on the economy. So perhaps doing better than other countries, but still it has had a significant impact.
Mm. And briefly on COP26, China, a major player here, an involvement in climate change. Will they attend?
I don't think Xi Jinping is going to go to Glasgow. And I think, this may come as a shock to some participants, but I don't think it was ever really on the cards. Xi Jinping has not left China since the beginning of the outbreak back in January 2020. So the idea that he may fly out of Beijing to attend a summit in a country where there are reported 100,000 cases a day just really seems far-fetched. Plus the fact that he has a lot to deal with at home. He is trying to institute policies to bring about what he calls this common prosperity, which will mean increasing taxes on the wealthy. It's quite a precarious time for the Chinese leader at the moment. He feels that that's a very difficult thing to manage. So he wants to be at home for that. Okay. Plus the fact that we have these economic difficulties with regard to the property market that we've discussed. So I think the idea of him leaving at this point is unlikely. And the second thing to think about here, China feels it's made all of its concessions on the climate, particularly with carbon neutrality. So it doesn't have anything left to give. It doesn't see the need to attend.
Yvonne Murray in Taipei, thank you very much.
Searches on the Kildare-Wicklow border by Gardaí investigating the disappearance of Deirdre Jacob and other women who went missing over 20 years ago has ended. In a statement yesterday, Gardaí said that nothing of evidential value to the investigations was recovered. Alan Bailey, a former Gardaí sergeant in charge of the Cold Case Unit, spoke with us earlier this month when the searches began. Alan is with us again this morning. Thank you for joining us. When you spoke with us on the 11th of October, Alan, you described these latest searches as a significant development. You might remind us what prompted them.
It's evidence that had come in previously, and then some new evidence seemed to copper fasten what was said on the time, and that led Gardaí to decide to take on this huge operation. And that, as I said at that outset, one fear was that this was going to be another false dawn for the family. They've had a lot of them, and they must have, that news yesterday, although they would have been kept informed throughout the search of where it was going, must have come as a devastating blow to the family.
Does it surprise you then that, as Gardaí say, nothing of evidential value to the investigations was discovered?
These searches, Angus, have been going on for years and years. I was involved for 13 odd years in searches of this nature myself. And all you can do is keep going at them and hopeful that one day we'll get it right and that we'll get to the bottom and maybe bring some closure to at least one of the families involved.
Alan, you say you've been involved in many of these searches in your time. When Gardaí undertake these sorts of searches, should they be publicising them in the manner they are? For example, it's been suggested that when there's a search announced and it doesn't uncover anything, as you say, it could have a very negative effect, particularly on the family.
That's correct. And just not one family, but there's a number of families that are affected by the missing persons. It's something we on Operation Trace, in my time, didn't do. We just went ahead and did our search. If it leaked out, well and good, we confirmed it. But I've seen developers like media conferences held at search sites and that's something we would never have done and certainly wouldn't have encouraged.
You headed up the Gardaí Cold Case Unit. These searches revolved around the disappearances of up to 8 women, including Deirdre Jacob and Jojo Dullard in the 90s. 2 high-profile missing persons cases. What do we know about their disappearances?
Again, it's the ordinariness of it all. Deirdre was walking on the street, on the road, outside her front own house. She stood. The last sighting of Deirdre was standing at her garden gate about to enter the house. And has never been seen since. Within 2 hours of that, her mother returned to the house, found that Deirdre wasn't in the home, alerted Gardaí, and by 8 o'clock that night, searches were underway. So, I mean, it kicked into a missing person search straight away, and nothing was ever found. Similarly with Jojo, she was tumbling on the side of the road late at night, and it might seem strange to us at this stage, but years ago, it was quite a common occurrence for people to be out tumbling lifts late at night in the road. Nobody thought anything of it. And I'd imagine the disappearance of Georgia was one thing that ended that practice.
And finally then, Alan, Gardaí say they will continue to keep the families involved updated on the progress of these investigations, but with no significant evidence discovered, as we now know, what's likely to happen next with these cases?
Well, it shows that the investigations are ongoing, this search, and you'd be hopeful that maybe something will, the publicity surrounding these searches may have a positive effect, and it may just trigger someone.
Alan Bailey, former Garda Sergeant in charge of the Cold Case Unit. We'll leave it there. Thank you very much for your time this morning.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. Discover our 2-to-1 offers at your local Kia dealer. For more, log on to kia.com.
And there's great joy in this morning's newspaper pictures of the Republic of Ireland celebrating victory over Finland. Des, more.
Yeah, lots of coverage, as you say. A 2-1 victory over Finland in Helsinki. The Finns ranked well above Ireland, the second favourites in the group, behind Sweden. But this win gives Vera Pauw's Irish side a huge boost in that qualifying group after goals from Megan Connolly and Denise O'Sullivan, the second courtesy of a poor goalkeeping error. But Ireland can now look forward to sell-out games in Tallinn next month for the visit of Slovakia and Georgia, and 6 points from those games would put Ireland in a very strong position for qualifying. Tony O'Donoghue spoke to the Irish coach Vera Pauw.
This was not our most beautiful game, but the most effective game. And if you see the way that they can have the discipline to play that style when we need it, that is amazing. And you can only say that all those defeats that we had with all those high-ranked teams, without those defeats, we wouldn't have been able to do this.
But momentum is such an important thing in sport, and now you've got it.
Yeah. We said it needs to turn round. The luck needs to come our way. We had a few times luck. If you can score immediately after having received a goal in, that's fantastic, because that means that this team is so flexible in their acting already.
You've got the 3 points on the road, which is always difficult against an opponent ranked higher than you.
Yeah.
What will this do for the confidence now?
Well, it gives us such a boost that we can get out of this group. We can. It will many games to go, many difficult games to go, because Slovakia is also a very difficult game. And even Georgia, they won 3-0 from Georgia, and if you see the pressure that they put on us. But it's a good boost, and next month we have the next games.
Yeah, a fine win. In Belfast, Northern Ireland drew 2-2 with Austria. Suffered late heartache, really, the Northern team, because Stephanie Enziger's stoppage time equaliser denied the North what would have been a famous win. 2 goals in 5 minutes from Laura Wade and Demi Vance had put Northern Ireland in control after Barbara Dunst gave Austria a first half lead, but they couldn't quite hold out for a third win in Group D. It finished level. Now, the FAI has warned fans not to buy any illicit tickets for next month's clash between Ireland and Portugal after tickets were found to be selling for 4 times face value on touting sites. Demand for the game was huge. Many fans were left disappointed as tickets sold out within minutes of going on sale. Last night, the FAI acknowledged the match tickets were currently circulating online at inflated price. They warned fans who purchased tickets they risk being denied entry. There are dodgy tickets around. We'll have more on that from Angus in just a few minutes. Elsewhere, it was a bittersweet night for Southampton's young Irish international Will Smallbone at Stamford Bridge. Having recovered from a serious ACL injury, Smallbone was introduced by Southampton in the second half of their League Cup game at Chelsea for his first game in 9 months. Southampton held on for a very good 1-1 draw after Shea Adams cancelled out Kai Havertz's opener for Chelsea, but the game then went to penalties. Smallbone took one but missed it. He and Theo Walcott both missed, so Reece James scored the winner for Chelsea on penalties. At the Emirates Stadium, Callum Chambers and Eddie Nketiah scored for Arsenal in a 2-0 win over Leeds. And League One side Sunderland are also through to the last 8. They beat Queen's Park Rangers 3-1 on penalties after the side finished scoreless at the end of normal time. In boxing, JP Hale represents Ireland at the World Championships in Belgrade today. The Irish lightweight faced a tough task against local fighter Semiz Alicic. In rugby, the Six Nations chief executive Ben Morrell insists There are no plans to add Southampton to the Six Nations Championship, with enhancement of both the July and November window seen as a greater priority for him. In racing, Cheltenham Gold Cup hero Manella Indo had 7 confirmations for the champion chase at Dunroyal on Saturday. And action today, Angus, is at Dundalk. The first race is off at 3:30.
The Republic of Ireland Men's World Cup qualifier match against Portugal next month is a sellout, with the Aviva Stadium set to host over 51,000 soccer fans for the first time in 2 years. But the FAI last night acknowledged that match tickets are circulating online at inflated prices. The maximum original sale price of tickets was €120, but they're reportedly being resold for up to 3 times that amount. This despite a new law banning ticket touting coming into force during the summer. One of those looking to buy tickets for the match online yesterday was Mick Hogan from Navan.
I was queuing on 2 devices before 10 o'clock for the match. I was seeking either a family ticket or a parent and child ticket, specifically those because I wanted to bring my 11-year-old. And the event was sold out in minutes, and by 11 o'clock they were up on offer on Viagogo. The cheapest price I've seen was 238, and that was just for a standard ticket in the Upper West or Upper West stand. And it makes me feel angry. I've never been able to bring the kids to an Ireland game because of the price of the tickets.
To discuss this further, we're joined by Sinn Féin spokesperson on enterprise, trade and employment, Louise O'Reilly, and Gareth O'Hearn, the Fine Gael Seanad spokesperson on enterprise and trade. Louise, I'll come to you first. We heard there from Mick Hogan the difficulty he had had trying to get tickets at a reasonable price yesterday. What do you make of the situation?
Well, I've had fans contacting me as well. I mean, at the end of the day, the legislation was brought in to protect sports fans and music fans, and it's obviously not doing its job. The FAI knew that this event was going to sell out. They knew that this game was going to be popular. They were tweeting in the 24 hours running up to it to fans to tell them to get online to make sure they got their tickets. But there is a section in the legislation which allows the Tánaiste to actually designate an event to be protected. And I'm really, really disappointed that he didn't do that on this occasion. The FAI have obviously got a case to answer as well, and I do hope that they will ensure that this doesn't happen for the future. But really, there is a clause in the legislation that allows the government and the Tánaiste specifically to designate an event due for protection under the Act. Mm-hmm. And I think he should have done that in this instance, and he didn't. And I think that's very regrettable, because at the end of the day, it's the fans that lose out. It's people like we just heard from Mick there in Navan who want to bring their kids to the games. They're the ones that are going to end up getting ripped off. It was very obvious that this was going to happen, that this event was going to be popular, and that indeed it was going to sell out and fans were going to be left without tickets. But I think the purpose of the legislation is to stop fans getting gouged, and it hasn't worked in this instance. And I think the government do need to take a good, long, hard look at how they can be proactive on this.
All right, Gareth O'Hearn, this new ticket touting law came in just under 3 months ago. The first time it's needed, it doesn't do what it's designed to, stopping tickets being sold for highly inflated amounts.
Yeah, well, look, I think myself and Louise would agree in sharing our frustration for genuine fans who logged on like Mick yesterday to try to get tickets, and within 45 minutes those tickets were sold out, and then they themselves were redirected to other sites to buy tickets for an increased amount. The responsibility for this is on the FAI to apply to be a designated venue. And the FAI should have done that. The legislation that was brought in July was to cover genuine fans. That's why the Tánaiste, and that's why Fine Gael made that commitment. It was done on the back of concerts that happened 3 or 4 years ago. I think it was U2 were having concerts in Dublin where there was tickets being sold for 20, 30 times the value of the original price of tickets, which was just completely unfair for fans and people who wanted to go to the show. But you know, we need to be patient here as well. The industry have had a very difficult 18 months. They're just getting back on their feet. Full capacity for events has just started since last week. So, you know, I think in fairness to the Minister for State, Robert Troy, he has written to all organisations, to the FAI, to the IRFU, reminding them of their responsibility.
He has done so to register. He has, but Gard Éireann, would it not make more sense to have all events automatically designated and organisers could instead apply for an exemption if, for example, they're running some sort of charity event trying to raise funds? It would have prevented what we're seeing now, or could have prevented what we're seeing now with the Ireland-Portugal match.
Yeah, well, at the time the legislation was being put forward, it was the Attorney General's advice that it was easier for Gardaí to police by doing it this way. The intent was to allow designation of the Act to cover one-year events also, so events that would take place just once a year, so not just a venue and events. So obvious things like that would be Electric Picnic or Live the Marquee in Cork. So, you know, venue operators themselves would be best placed to know which events and which venues would have to apply for these events, because it's for people over 1,000 people who'd come to a venue where it applies for. Mm-hmm. So look, it's very early days. The legislation has just been enacted. In fairness to the music industry, the entertainment industry, the sports industry, they have had an awful lot of challenges over the last 18 months. This legislation was brought forward by government to protect fans, and it will protect fans.
Indeed, and hopefully the rationale behind the law is clear. Louise O'Reilly, I'll come back to you. It's clear in the legislation the onus is on organisers to apply to have their events designated so tickets can't be sold higher than face value. Should they be taking some of the responsibility here?
Absolutely, but it's also clear in the legislation that the minister, in this case, Fine Gael's Leo Varadkar, can designate an event or a venue. And I've PQ'd this, so I've asked questions directly of the department and of Minister Varadkar in relation to this, and it appears that only 3 applications have been received up until the end of September. So if the industry is not going to be proactive, well, then the government should be proactive. And indeed, the Tánaiste was explicit in providing that those powers via this legislation to himself. So it's not simply a case that that we can put all of the blame onto the venues and onto the organisers. Clearly, the FAI knew that this was going to happen. They absolutely should have applied to be designated. But there is a section in the legislation that allows for the government to be proactive about this. The fans have been let down, not just because the FAI have allowed this to happen, but they've been let down because the government allowed this to happen. I mean, Gareth said there that Fine Gael made a commitment to protect fans, but fans weren't protected in this regard. They've actually been let down. So I think, you know, the legislation has fallen essentially at the first hurdle. We just need to see the government being proactive about it now to ensure that fans are protected, because at the end of the day, that's what we all want to see, is genuine fans accessing tickets at face value. And I think that's what Mick from Navan wants. He wants to be able to bring his kids to the match for a reasonable price. Mm-hmm. That's what genuine fans want. You know, we need to stamp out ticket touting, because at the end of the day, it's the fans that lose out. The government have the power to do it. They didn't do it in this case. Let's hope they learn from this and they ensure that they do actually use the powers that they have given themselves to protect genuine fans.
In the case of the Ireland-Portugal match, we know initially no designation was sought by the FAI, Gareth Ahern, but in a statement to Morning Ireland last night, the FAI said it has now applied to designate the match under the law. The next potential challenge for to see if this law is effective will come in just over 2 weeks. We have the Autumn Internationals with rugby. Ireland will play New Zealand in one of those games, very likely to be a sellout. Any plans there for getting the IRFU to ask for a designation, or has contact been made in that regard?
Yeah, so look, I think there's a couple of things. The FAI have said that they've designated the they've applied to designate the match or the event as designated. What I'd like is that the venue is designated, because once the venue is designated, then all matches that happen in the venue is designated. Louise would know that we had submissions from the FAI when this was going through pre-legislative scrutiny in the Committee of Enterprise and Trade, and they were hugely supportive of this legislation coming through. But you're right, Angus, like today is actually a critical day, because tomorrow at 12 o'clock, tickets go on sale for the Ireland-New Zealand game that's going to be on the 13th of November. The designation has to be made before those tickets go on sale by the IRFU to make sure the tickets cannot be sold at over market value. I would encourage and I would expect that the IRFU, along with the FAI, if they were doing anything today, that they would be applying to have the venue designated for the Autumn Internationals. Everyone knows that match between Ireland and New Zealand is going to be a sellout. All they have to do is apply. It doesn't have to be granted. It'll be granted within a week. They just need to apply today for it to work. And we've seen...
Sorry, Garda Herman, just very tight on time and I need to come back in, bring Louise Riley back in very quickly. Louise, you've heard what Garrett has been saying there about the event organisers should be looking to designate this themselves. But do you think, for example, for the New Zealand game in a couple of weeks' time, that the government should be stepping in very briefly?
Well, absolutely. If the IRFU don't apply, then I would like to see the government designate this. It's very clear soccer fans have been let down. Let's see if the government are going to take action now for rugby fans in the next couple of hours.
Okay, Louise O'Reilly and Garda Hearn, thank you both for your time this morning.
The volume of traffic through Dublin Port fell 3.3% in the first 9 months of the year, according to new figures released this morning, though container traffic at the port was down just 0.5%. The impact of Brexit can also be seen in the figures, with container and trailer traffic to and from Britain down 21.2% and traffic from continental ports up 36.3%. Eamon O'Reilly is Chief Executive of Dublin Port and he joins me on the line now. Eamon, that shift in traffic, is it an actual change in where the goods are coming from, or is it the same traffic but coming directly rather than over the UK land bridge?
Good morning, Adam. The same goods are coming in and out this year as were coming last year, but they're coming by different routes and to and from different locations. So what we've seen from our perspective is a very flat year, as you say, our containers and trailers down by just 0.5%, but I think a very remarkable shift in the makeup of that business, whereby before Brexit, about two-thirds of all of the containers and trailers were moving between Ireland and Britain. Now that's dropped to half. So our business is now 50-50 between Britain and the EU, and overall our volumes are flat, when we would have expected to see growth because of the economy improving. So I think what we're also seeing is a dislocation to Northern Irish ports from Dublin Port, which is going to be a permanent feature, I think, going forward.
Another change that you mention in the figures is a drop in the number of containers that are being accompanied by a driver. Why is that bad news?
It's bad news because if you think of the Port of Dover, the Port of Dover operates on a footprint or on a footprint of a postage stamp, and it has about 2 million, 2.5 million trailers moving in and out. And it can do that because every single one of them has a driver with the container or the trailer, and they simply drive off the ship and out the port gate. With a drop in the number of accompanied in Dublin Port, we now have a larger number of trailers sitting in the port for a period of time. And when trailers sit, that requires land, and land is the one thing that we're not flush with in Dublin Port.
We know there are ongoing issues in the global supply chain. You say you're seeing pressure and capacity. Yesterday, the Irish Times reported on a 20-fold increase in some Department of Agriculture checks on containers due to Brexit. Are you confident that Dublin Port won't become congested in the lead up to Christmas?
I think there's two different issues there within your question. On the border controls are working remarkably effectively. So if you take a typical ferry coming in from the UK with maybe up to 100 trailers on it, less than three of them, on average, are being taken for some form of physical inspection of goods. So we're seeing absolutely no delays in the port because of border inspection checks. In fact, we see a lot of the facilities that Customs and Department of Agriculture put in being very lightly used. The international supply chain issues, I don't think we're going to see those in Ireland, because those are concentrated around the huge ports like Los Angeles is the most obvious example in news, but also a place like Rotterdam. The problems that happen there are happening with the really big ships that are never going to come into Dublin. And the problem effectively gets filtered at Rotterdam, and all of the goods come on the much smaller ships into Dublin, and we're not seeing and don't expect to see any of that congestion coming with those ships.
Briefly, you mentioned that dislocation of trade to Northern Ireland ports. We've also seen the likes of Rosslare and Cork becoming more popular as direct routes from continental Europe. Is growth going to be much harder for Dublin Port post-Brexit?
Not at all, no. The amount of volume that we've lost to the likes of Rosslare and Cork, it's tiny. It's in the fraction of a percentage in the case of Cork, and I'm estimating something like 2 or 3% in the case of Rosslare. So I think we're going to be treading water this year, Adam, and we're going to return to growth next year. I'm expecting by 2023 that Dublin Port's volumes will be back to the record levels we saw in 2019.
Okay. Eamon O'Reilly, Chief Executive of Dublin Port, thank you very much for that.
Ireland's win against Finland in the Women's World Cup soccer qualifier yesterday is celebrated in photographs on three front pages. Happy women in green are pictured in the Irish Examiner, Irish Independent and Irish Times. By contrast, the face of John Traynor, who died in the UK on Sunday, appears on three other front pages. He is described in the Irish Daily Star as an infamous mobster. He was Evil John Gilligan's former right-hand man, according to the Irish Daily Mirror. The Irish Sun says Traynor was centrally involved in the planning of the murder of the Sunday Independent reporter Veronica Guerin. The three papers' headline writers agree on their verdict. Blood on his hands, say the Sun and Mirror. He got away with murder, says the Star. The other papers look elsewhere for their lead stories. The Independent reports that first-time buyers are being squeezed out of the market for new homes, with cash-rich purchasers and cuckoo funds snapping up half the available stock. Just 24 hours after the publication of its plan to cut carbon emissions by 51% in the next decade, the government has been warned that it does not go far enough, so says the Examiner. A United Nations Environment Programme report demands emissions reductions of at least 55%, and Ireland's carbon budgets, published on Monday, fall short of that, the paper says. That UN report is the main story for the Irish Daily Mail as well. The headline writer sums up its message, "Wake up or face climate catastrophe." A stark warning is mentioned in the Times lead headline, but it's about the trajectory of COVID-19, and it was given in a presentation to a cabinet subcommittee last night by the Minister for Health, Stephen Donnelly. Members were told that cases were as high now as at any point apart from the peak of the January wave, and there were no guarantees that a coming peak in infection would rapidly fall away in the run-in to Christmas. On the other hand, the Examiner reports that the Cabinet Subcommittee on COVID-19 heard that a high level of compliance in the enforcement of COVID certificates was found last weekend in venues across the country. For a personal response to the matter, there is a column in the Times by Roisin Ingle. She writes about her unvaccinated relative who lives abroad, is thinking of coming home for Christmas and has asked to stay with her. In an editorial, The Independent says that while messaging on vaccines and boosters may have become slightly muddled, the science is straightforward and reassuring. Your vaccine is still cutting your risk of getting a severe case or dying from the virus. In other stories, The Independent reports that there is a perfect storm in the market for second-hand cars, and they have increased in price by 16%. One of the main factors for the increase, Eddie Cunningham writes, is the restrictions on UK second-hand imports following Brexit. Perhaps the answer is to be found in France. Neil Briscoe writes in the Times about the electrically powered Citroën Ami, which is not a car at all, but technically a quadricycle. It's extremely small, with a top speed of 45 kilometres per hour and a range of 75 kilometres. Owning it yourself is not really the idea, says Briscoe. What will eventually happen is that micro-renting services will buy fleets of these and leave them stashed at strategic points. As a way to get around town using minimal resources, the Citroën Ami is something close to genius, he says.
The chief medical officer is increasingly worried about the rising incidence of COVID-19 nationwide, and we now have the highest COVID levels in hospitals since last March. The Irish Times reporting this morning that Minister Stephen Donnelly gave what was described as a stark presentation to the Cabinet Subcommittee on COVID-19. Numbers in ICU up 22% in the past week, numbers in hospital up 41% in the last fortnight. There were 2,193 new cases of COVID-19 confirmed yesterday. Liam Woods is the HSE National Director of Acute Hospitals, and good morning to you, Liam Woods. The numbers here, 513 COVID cases in hospital right now, 97 in ICU. How much pressure is on the hospital system now, and how much pressure is on hospital staff?
Good morning, Mary. I think the answer is there is a lot of pressure and growing pressure on the hospital system and on hospital staff right now. As you've referred to, COVID has increased significantly in recent weeks, and the numbers of cases in the community would suggest that within hospitals it will go further, because as we're aware at this stage in the pandemic, there is a lag effect between the community incidents and what's going on in our hospitals. I think Dr. O'Connor from James's yesterday was flagging to you that now half of their ICU is occupied with COVID patients. So it's an increasing pressure that we now need to respond to, and are taking measures to try and work as best we can, both in the delivery of normal services. And I think it's important to recognise that right now hospitals are running beyond the 2019 levels in terms of emergency department attendances. And so much has returned to normal within the system, but we're also now dealing with a growing level of COVID, which, as you've said in your intro, is now at the highest level since January, February of this year, which was the peak.
Now, there are lots of issues there. Let's talk about this lag effect. We've heard modelling from Philip Nolan suggesting within the next 2 to possibly 3 weeks, you could have anything up to 200 people in your ICUs. You could have between 1,000 and 2,000 in hospital. Are they the figures that you're working towards, and how do you make provision for that?
Yes, the modelling, we take information from the modelling all the time. We would hope it wouldn't go that high, but having said that, we're alert to the notion that there are nearly 100 people at the moment in ICU, and would have peaked previously at just over 200.
And just to remind ourselves, sorry, just on that, how many vacant ICU beds do you have as of this morning?
So in total, there are 301 ICU beds, and we have 100 occupied, just under 100 occupied with COVID. In terms of vacant beds, the answer is normally very few, between 15 and 20, normally reflecting movement of patients. That ICU bed capacity has grown by 50 in the last 12 months, which is very helpful, and there is a commitment to grow that further, up toward 440, and that's a key investment really in our health services. In terms of managing the response to the pressure that's on ICU, to the question you asked me there, Mary, our intensivists are working in effect daily to get best use of the ICU beds. Our mobile intensive care ambulance service is moving patients between locations, which is a normal part of health service delivery, but at this time becomes more used to deal with stress in individual locations. So a hospital like Limerick this morning has 49 patients with COVID on site. That's a very significant requirement in care terms for staff to provide. Galway and the Mater would also be very high at 34 and 31. So these are major impacts in terms of normal care provision and, of course, serious service requirements for those individual patients.
Now, as you call it, normal care provision, what normal care provision will just have to wait, will have to be cancelled and deferred, these elective and planned procedures that people have been waiting months, if not years, for?
So I think the impact of spikes in COVID on waiting times for service, unfortunately, is negative. And our experience has been that we've seen an accumulation of waiting primarily for elective, for planned procedures, mostly surgical procedures. We have bought service and continue to in the private sector to offset some of that loss in the public system. But in reality, when we experience increases in COVID at the level we are at the moment, it has a real impact in our capacity to provide other services.
So what are we experiencing right now, and taking into account the numbers, the anticipated numbers you were talking about, what are you providing for in terms of cancelling and deferring some of these elective procedures?
Yeah, so that actually would happen site by site, depending on demand for COVID care. At the moment, what we're allowing for is we have an arrangement in place with the private sector. We refer to a safety net. That's been there since March last year. So we are sending work to the private sector where that can be done.
Let me put it this way to you. Everybody who had received notification of a planned procedure for this morning, will all of those planned procedures go ahead?
Well, if there was a cancellation, the hospital would make contact with the individual. Just to give you an example, when we looked last week at what was happening with planned procedures, we could see cancellations in relatively low numbers, but still maybe 10 per site. And that's significant, clearly, for the individuals. And it's a further requirement on the hospital to provide care at a future point. And those appointments will be rescheduled as soon as possible, clearly, subject to the COVID impact on the site.
And what about this arrangement, as you say, that you have with the private hospitals? Have you any facility now to improve on or change that arrangement?
So we have, since March last year, had the capacity to use private hospitals, and it has worked very well. It's been very successful at providing care, cancer care and other critical care for patients. In terms of change and improvement, I think the requirement for us in the near term is to continue to use it in the way that we have. And it's about getting as many patients as we can to that environment for operations. And that's what we're at.
But if you need to bring the private sector in more because of these rising COVID numbers, can you do it? Are you in talks to do it?
We have that capacity already in the agreement we entered into last March. We also, just to reference, as a result of the cyber attack in May, made further specific arrangements with the private sector to support care delivery. And so we have been able to use the private capacity effectively. It's important to remember private hospitals are also affected by COVID, so they face challenges not dissimilar to the public hospitals. But we have been successful at using them to support public care needs, which we will continue to do.
Now, we heard last week that you had, I think, 1,800 healthcare workers out with COVID-19. Do you have the latest figures?
That's the latest number I have at the moment.
And that is still a huge figure for you to contend with. And is that doesn't include the numbers that would be out with other health issues?
No, indeed. I think at its peak, if you go back to January, February, the peak would have been maybe 5,700 staff out with COVID-related illness. So 1,800 is a concerning figure. I think in overall staff terms, just to reflect, the staff in the health system has grown in total numbers by 10,800 since the start of the pandemic. And that's important. That's very significant investment in doctors and nurses and other care providers. We've increased doctors by almost 1,200 and nurses by 2,800. So, but having said that, that investment has been significantly needed to address the COVID challenge we're facing.
Would you and your colleagues in the HSE and those healthcare workers like to see a decision now on a booster vaccine for the healthcare staff?
I think NIAC make those recommendations, so obviously we will adhere to the recommendations coming from NIAC, and at the moment we're engaged in vaccination of both immunocompromised individuals and people in nursing homes over 65. Should there be a recommendation for a booster for staff, then clearly we would move to implement that as part of our immunisation programme.
But as one of the experts says this morning in the papers, you know, we don't have a transmission blocking vaccine at the moment, and the evidence appears to be that the present vaccine, the bonus of not transmitting whatever was there, declines over time. So how crucial is it to keep the health service going, that this booster be given to
healthcare workers? I think the clinical evidence, as you've reflected there, Mary, is the key point. At the moment, we're still seeing very low levels of infection among staff, but small rises. And yes, we'd be very supportive of a booster shot for staff, should that be the decision of NIAC.
Does it need to happen soon?
Evidence-based, and really for NIAC and clinical evidence to determine.
The HSE also has a programme underway to try to encourage what we'll call, I suppose, vaccine avoiders to take the jab. How is that going for you?
So we are still running the vaccine centres and walk-in vaccination centres, and there is an increase in numbers attending those. So that is demonstrating some success. We're also running pop-up clinics in hospitals and maternity hospitals as a facility for the public. And as the Chief Medical Officer said yesterday, vaccination is still our best defence. Mm-hmm. So it's very important that continues and that it's successful.
360,000, I think, unvaccinated or a first vaccine when they didn't receive the second. By what level would you anticipate reducing that?
Well, I think we simply need to keep providing service. The target would be to reduce that very significantly, but we need people to continue to attend and be vaccinated as the best line of defence that we have. Very alert to the fact that we still have significant admissions to hospital of people who are not vaccinated.
We heard from the HSE, or I should say from HICWA yesterday, about information systems in the healthcare service. We heard about GPs still having to write letters to some sectors of the HSE, and people delivering service to older people in the community still using paper systems. Given the cyber attack, have you been able to avail of an opportunity to build back better?
Yes, I think there have been opportunities and learnings from the cyber attack that have facilitated that. and indeed COVID. So the vaccination system itself is a single national solution that works very well. There are other such solutions in place in areas like radiology, referred to as NIMAS. But the HICWA report, which makes a range of recommendations around workforce and legislative and indeed standards for information provision, I think is to be welcomed. I heard, I think it was Rachel Flynn on your show yesterday. And yes, we'd be very supportive of the conclusions of the report. And the HSE has had the opportunity both to invest and learn from the cyber attack.
Liam Woods, there we must leave it for now. Thank you very much for joining us. Liam Woods, HSE National Director of Acute Hospitals.
Thousands of new parents have been waiting up to 5 months to register their child's birth due to the ongoing impact of May's cyber attack on the HSE. And the issue isn't just a red tape problem, with the registration delays also meaning parents cannot access vital supports like child benefit when they need it most. As Fiacra O'Kinney reports.
Hello, Alison, how are you?
Hi, Fiacra. Nice to meet you. This is baby Finn.
Alison and Stephen McCabe's baby son Finn was born on the 1st of June. But the couple from Clonsilla in Dublin say lengthy delays mean they won't be given a birth cert until November.
Between COVID and the cyber attack, everything was kind of delayed. 3-4 months passed and we still hadn't heard anything. So I sent an email. Somebody got back to me to say the original application had been lost. I was told then the birth certificate would be up to 30 working days, which means he will be probably about 6 months old before we get a birth certificate for him.
The issue has been caused by May's HSE cyber attack. But while baby Finn is now being officially registered, the McCabe's problems don't end there, as the delays mean the family is still waiting for state supports they were meant to receive when their child was born.
It impacts on a lot. You can't apply for your GP visit card, can't get a passport, we can't get his baptism cert, we can't get his children's allowance. It's a lot of chasing, which you don't need when you have a new baby and a toddler. It should just kind of be straightforward.
In nearby Dublin City, Natasha Glumachik and her partner Rory tell a similar story about their four-month-old son, Liam.
A couple of days after arriving home, we completed the online forms to register his birth. Fast forward to October, we still had no information and no birth certificate. I decided to call, but I got an automated message saying they were receiving a large volume of calls and they can't accept any more calls and the line was disconnected.
While it's a different reason to Alison's, Natasha says the delays are also difficult for her family.
Now, the reason why I wanted to get his birth certificate is so I can apply for his passport and go see my family in Croatia. I might not be able to go. This was quite upsetting.
Natasha and Alison are just two of thousands of new mothers facing the same issue. So what's happened and why? Karen Kiernan is CEO of support group One Family.
Well, we started to get calls to our helpline during the summer from parents who weren't able to get their children's birth registered. The reason they were told that was happening was due to the cybersecurity attack on the HSE and the HSE trying to catch up with all of those birth reg problems. So that's where it's originated. There are still delays.
The HSE doesn't dispute the issues, saying the cyber attack meant it couldn't access its files between May and July. It says the reopening of local walk-in registration units in early October means average delays have now fallen in the worst affected counties, Dublin, Kildare and Wicklow, from a high of 16 weeks in midsummer to 8 weeks today. Separate HSE figures given to Social Democrats TD for Wicklow, Jennifer Whitmore, say at the start of October, delays ranged between 3 and 11 weeks nationwide, with Dublin, Monaghan and Cavan worst affected. The small improvements are no consolation for another affected family.
We knew there might be some delays in getting her birth certificate. However, we didn't think it would take the time or the effort that it ended up taking.
Limerick-based couple Rachel and David Birmingham's daughter, Mairead, was born in early August. While they have recently been able to register Mairead's birth, Rachel says the delays still have worrying consequences.
This meant 2 months I was without PPS number, no child benefit, no GP card, and we couldn't apply for her Irish passport or her US passport. We are lucky that we don't depend on those child benefit payments, but you know, other families are not so fortunate.
Support groups like One Family agree with Rachel. Here's Karen Kiernan again.
The reason people were ringing the One Family helpline was because they were absolutely stuck. We'd like the HSE to prioritise those parents who need the PPS number now to support themselves and their child, because you can't get supplementary welfare allowance for a child that doesn't legally exist.
For its part, the Department of Social Protection said it is listening to the concerns. A spokesperson told Morning Ireland it cannot give financial supports until a BERT is registered with the HSE. But once a registration takes place, the spokesperson said a parent will receive child benefit within 2 weeks, including all previously missed payments. Parents like Alison McCabe say the help can't come soon enough.
In November, I'll start my unpaid leave. So having the children's benefits to get those essential things that Finn needs, every little bit will help.
Alison McCabe and her 4.5-month-old son, Finn. Ending that report by Fiacra O'Kioni.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. Discover our 2-to-1 offers at your local Kia dealer. For more, log on to kia.com.
24 minutes to 9 on Morning Ireland, and it's back over to Des Cahill for the sports news.
Yeah, thanks, Angus. We're going to start with last night's League Cup action in England, because it was a bittersweet night for Southampton's young Irish international Will Smallbone at Stamford Bridge. Having recovered from a serious ACL injury, Smallbone was introduced by Southampton in the second half of their League Cup game at Chelsea. It was his first match for 9 months. Now, Southampton held on for a very creditable 1-1 draw after Che Adams cancelled out Kai Havertz's opener for Chelsea, so the game went to penalties and Smallbone was brave enough to step up and take one, but he and Theo Walcott missed for the Saints, so Reece James scored the winner for Chelsea, who advanced. At the Emirates Stadium, Callum Chambers and Eddie Nketiah scored for Arsenal in a 2-0 win over Leeds. Now, Chambers' goal was a bit unusual because he scored with literally his first touch of the game.
It's pretty quick, to be honest. You know, the guys on the sideline, set piece coach, Nico and the boss, you know, they said, you know, you're going to score from your first touch. They convinced me, so I went on thinking that was going to happen, and luckily it did, so yeah, it's a nice moment.
Is that what the celebration was? Because you charged over there, didn't you? So what was it led to that feeling from all of you?
It was just that, you know, they were saying as I was about to come on, you know, they're all really getting into my ear going, you're going to score, get your head on it, first touch, going to get the goal. So yeah, obviously when it happened, just straight back over to them and celebrating with them. It was a nice moment.
It was a great celebration. Do you know when the last goal was, how many days ago it was?
My last goal?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know.
765 days ago, was your last goal for Arsenal.
Yeah. No, it's always nice to score a goal. So yeah, it was good.
What did you make of the team's performance? You're into the next round.
Good performance, good to get a clean sheet, a couple of goals as well. I think playing against Leeds is never easy. They're a unique team in the way they play, so you've got to be ready. You've got to change your mentality a little bit in the way you think. I think we did that really well. We prepared well, and we're all at it and up for the fight, which is the main thing you have to do against Leeds. You have to fight and give 100%, and we did that today, and yeah, it was a good performance for us.
It was, and League One side Sunderland are also through to the last eight. They beat Queen's Park Rangers 3-1 on penalties after the sides finished scoreless at the end of normal time. Well, now for reaction to the Republic of Ireland women's team 2-1 victory over Finland in Helsinki. The Finns are second favourites in the group behind Sweden, but this win gives Fíorra Pau's Irish side a huge boost in the qualifying group after goals from Megan Connolly and Denise O'Sullivan. Ireland can now look forward to sell-out games in Tallinn next month for the visit of Slovakia and Georgia. 6 points from those games would put Ireland in a very strong position. Megan Connolly, who scored direct from a free kick, explained to Donny O'Donoghue why she took it rather than Katie McCabe.
We were just standing over it for, I felt like forever, and we just kept looking, do we want to in-swing it or go back post, or kind of, you know, we just kept saying it, and then just last minute I just said, I'll take it. You know, Katie said, what you want? I said, I'll do it. And then, yeah, just I had belief in myself that, you know, I've practiced it enough times that, you know, hopefully tonight would be the night, and it was, so... Yeah, I think it came with the perfect time. We were kind of building, get it on the 10th minute, I think it was. Yeah, it just kind of helped settle a bit and just get us in the game. Taking free kicks before, obviously being on this team, there's a lot of people, you know, Katie can take free kicks, you know, with her eyes closed. But from that angle, it just felt that a right footer would kind of suit it more. But yeah, I don't want to give away my secrets too much. But yeah, I'm just glad that it contributed to the 2-1. And obviously Dee getting the second goal was so important 5 minutes after they scored.
Yeah, great win. And Irish coach Vera Powell admitted afterwards that Ireland may not have been the better team, but she was delighted with her side's resilience.
Well, let's start with how important it was, and that not the best footballing team has won, although the first 15 minutes we were very, very good, I think. We were all over them, but somehow we lost the grip. But their resilience is fantastic. If you see how they responded, the way we got the goal against, where before, where normally you would collapse. And I think that that came in to our team, especially the resilience, and keep holding on to your task, as if it's clinical what you're doing at that moment, that we get that out of all the games against higher ranked teams.
Yeah, meanwhile in Belfast, Northern Ireland's women team drew 2-2 with Austria. A bit of heartache for Northern Ireland because Stephanie Enziger equalised in stoppage time to deny Northern Ireland what would have been a famous win after they had taken the lead with goals from Laura Wade and Demi Vance. Now, the FAI has warned fans not to buy any illicit tickets for next month's clash between Ireland and Portugal after tickets were found to be selling for four times face value on touting sites. Demand for the game was huge. Many fans left disappointed as tickets sold out within minutes of going on sale. Last night, the FAI acknowledged the match tickets currently circulating online at inflated prices and warned fans who purchase tickets via this manner they risk being denied entry. In boxing, JP Hale represents Ireland at the World Championships in Belgrade today. The Irish lightweight takes on local fighter Semiz Alicic. In rugby, the Six Nations chief Ben Morrell insists there are no plans to add South Africa to the championship, with enhancement of the July and November windows seen as his greater priority. And in racing, Cheltenham Gold Cup hero Manella Indo had seven confirmations for the champion chase at Dunroyal on Saturday, and the action today, Angus, is at Dundalk. The first race is off at 3:30.
And an app to prevent food waste has launched here, which aims to rehome food that would otherwise be thrown out. More than 1 million tonnes of food waste is generated every year in Ireland. That represents a carbon footprint equivalent to 3.6 million tonnes of carbon dioxide. Globally, more than one third of all food is wasted. Eleanor Mannion reports.
Hotel chef Renato Palmer hates seeing good food go to waste. Today's leftovers look pretty tasty too.
So I got a little bit of a beetroot risotto.
And there's much more where that came from.
It is a little bit heartbreaking, and you know, and I've worked in a lot of kitchens and hotels, corporate places, restaurants, and you just kind of get to see how much of waste is actually there, you know. A lot of the time it's a third of everything that you produce just goes into the waste.
According to the Environmental Protection Agency, in Ireland we waste over 1 million tonnes of food each year. Renato's risotto isn't going to be wasted though. The Dublin hotel he works at has signed up to a food waste app which recently launched in Ireland. The Too Good To Go app enables businesses to list food for sale that would otherwise be thrown out. Customers can then buy the food at a discounted price. Jamie Crummy is co-founder of Too Good To Go.
It's so important that we fight food waste because of the environmental implications it has. In the climate emergency we find ourselves in, food waste accounts for 10% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. Meaning that if food waste was a country, you know, it would be the third largest greenhouse gas emitter after the US and China. You know, in fact, here in Ireland, you know, we're throwing away 1 million tons of food every single year. And at the same time, 1 in 11 people are food insecure. So it really is a crying shame that we're throwing so much perfectly edible food away.
In recent years, dozens of firms have set out to tackle food waste, including platforms like FoodCloud, Olio and Gander. Tracy Moran of Dublin City Centre Hotel Wren Urban Nest says partnering with Too Good To Go was too good an opportunity to miss.
Wren Urban Nest is all about sustainability. It's all about the little steps that we take towards a better planet. So for us, from a commercial point of view, it makes sense for us to work with someone like Too Good To Go, because it helps us, I suppose, form a direction in terms of how we manage our waste. And that's one of the big things that we're all about, is food waste and managing our food waste.
Food waste apps are proving a hit with climate-conscious consumers too. Melina Obradovic is picking up a surprise bag from Renato's kitchen at Wren.
Would some people be uncomfortable with the surprise aspect? Like, what would you
I
say
think that is the best part of it, you know? It's a surprise because you never gonna know what you're gonna get. And it's fun. It's not economical ways that you're throwing away food, you know, households, restaurants, hotels, etc. You're wasting the transportation, you're wasting water, you're wasting the heat. So all that sum up. And, you know, it's a great way to start reducing CO emissions in the first place.
And for Chef Renato, less waste means a happier kitchen and a healthier planet.
And we believe that any waste is a failure of the imagination. And so to be part of something like this, it really does push the boundary and it forces us to be a little bit more creative with our solutions.
Chef Renato Palmer from Wren Urban Nest Hotel, ending Eleanor Mannion's report.
Now, in these last few days of warm weather, maybe you're noticing more wasps than usual hovering in your personal space. We wondered, is that because this year there are more autumnal wasps about? Or is it simply because in their final days they come out to find food and create a little bit of a nuisance? Well, to tell us more, I'm joined by Ken Norton. Ken is chairman of the Lake County Beekeepers Association of Mullingar. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning. How are you?
Are we imagining it, or are there more wasps about this time of year than usual?
There are more wasps around. Now, you see, we may have a problem in so much as we have several different types of wasps. So the two most common wasps we will see would be one which resembles a sort of a little insect in a Kilkenny jersey, which is called vulgaris.
It's no reflection now on Kilkenny hurlers.
Yeah, which would be very common. Now, we also have another one down, which is a German wasp, which is called Germanica. Now, the problem with them being that there was a report a number of years ago about this hybrid wasp coming in 2017. Now, I rooted high and low and whatever, couldn't find my bits and pieces on it, but that's not to say it didn't happen. So probably Friday or Saturday I'll come across that information. But meantime, basically what happens is, some people would be saying it's due to climate change. It's not really what has happened with last year and this year. Because people are more at home due to the COVID, they're out more, they're rooting in their sheds outside, they're taking deck chairs out, all that sort of things, trampolines or whatever. Now, they're also out walking. So in the last, both last year and this year, for some reason or other, they've been coming across wasps, not high up in trees, but down below in little burrows, where normally bumblebees would live. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem with them being, of course, they're going along, they're disturbing them. Now, the common wasp, which is the vulgaris, which I talked about first, normally they would have maybe in the nest from probably 200 little lunatics, as I would call them, up to maybe 1,000 or 1,500. Now, the German wasp, then, which the Germanica, they would have maybe 10,000 wasps.
Oh, wow.
In a nest.
I see.
So
and
what
tell,
happens?
Yeah, sorry, Ken. What's the relationship then between the wasp and the honeybee?
Between the wasp and the honeybee. Well, the wasp is the beekeeper's main predator, and the beekeeper would really hate the wasp. Now, what happens is, you see, initially, the wasp starts off as a carnivore, so it's basically eating meat, little insects, aphids off plants and so on.
Yeah, so they're an important part, Ken, of the ecosystem.
Sorry?
As well. They are an important part of the ecosystem, aren't they?
I know they're detrimental to the honeybee. Certainly, if they stick to themselves. Now, what happens is, people talk about, oh, don't kill them, they're the great pollinator. Now, they are actually a pollinator, but it's mainly by accident, because later on in the year, when they're finished rearing all the children, shall we say, in the nests, they then go out and they're looking for something to eat themselves. Mm-hmm. So basically what they're doing is they're collecting nectar from the flowers that are out and about. So as they move from one to the other, by accident, they're actually pollinating whatever is
but
there.
But Ken, now, by I'm just out of time, by the hard frost, they'll be gone, won't they?
Sorry?
By the time we get a hard frost, the wasps will be gone.
Well, they will and they won't, you see, because the frost doesn't really kill them. What happens is, at the moment, most of the queens that have got mated, they're looking to get in somewhere to hibernate for the winter. So that's basically what's happening with them. So you'll see them on your windowsill, getting in your windows, in the bathroom, all that sort of things. So that's basically what's happening at the moment. Right. Now, the frost may kill a few if you don't get in out of the way, but any of that hibernate, the frost won't kill them.
That won't kill them off. All right, listen, Ken, sorry we're out of time. Good to talk to you. Thank you very much. Ken Norton there from the Beekeepers Association of Mullingar.
With COVID restrictions easing and countries beginning to open up again, it's likely to be a busy winter for air travel. But after heavily curtailing schedules during the pandemic, how quickly can airlines ramp up capacity and are they doing so? To find out, I'm joined by consumer journalist Siobhan Maguire. Good morning, Siobhan.
Good morning, Angus.
We'll get plenty to get through. We'll cover as much as we can with you. Airlines, they're getting ready to operate their winter schedules. Are they scaling back flights to any big degree?
Well, they are. I mean, what they're actually doing is putting on additional flights, but they are flying with limited capacity, Angus. So what we have at the moment are airlines across the world releasing details of the winter schedule, which runs from November until March. And that's been fairly positive because many are increasing the number of routes on last year, which is to be welcomed. And then we're going to have big international markets like the US and Australia come back into the fold by Christmas by lifting existing travel restrictions to visitors. Now, I don't want to be the negative person here this morning, Angus, but, you know, it's easy to think that more flights means greater competition, you know, and better value for us, the consumers. But there is going to be a price hike coming into the fold as well with all these new flights being released.
And probably a case of a lot of pent-up demand there. Does that mean as well with these limited schedules there's going to be less choice for consumers or more?
There will be more choice in terms of the number of flights being offered, but there will be limited seating capacity on these flights. Now, the big factor that's going to hit all of these flights and then have a knock-on effect to the consumer is the rise in jet fuel prices. So we have kind of aviation industry experts saying that they're increasing at a rate that the industry hasn't seen for the last 18 months. So what happens is they're paying more on jet fuel, and that has to be passed on then to the consumers in terms of the price of their air tickets.
And is there any indication, Siobhan, at this stage, is this a temporary situation in the air travel industry, or could we see this into the new year, indeed into the summer schedule, for example, that we could have smaller schedules for airlines and higher prices?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we have airline bosses like United Airlines and even Michael O'Leary and Ryanair warning that there will be price increases well into 2022. And that will have a knock-on effect then in terms of the price of hotels. So the whole travel experience is going up in price, and there's nothing that could be done about that. For the consumer as well, our choices are getting a little bit more limited as well. The days of being able to browse several flights and reserve of a couple and then go with the best price is gone as well. I think people who've been trying to book even in the last couple of weeks will have noticed that if they were reserving flights and went back to them, those particular flights were then gone. They had disappeared, because basically now you buy at the time of booking. You don't have the luxury of browsing.
And for those who don't, I know we often do it, we'll have a look at flight prices online. As you say, we'll come back and they could be gone, but sometimes they're at a much higher price. Any idea how much more people are likely to pay for airfares this winter than would be expected?
So we always look to the bigger international markets like the US for kind of guidance on trends in the aviation sector. And they are already warning domestic travellers over there about Thanksgiving flights going up 23%. And remember, that's, you know, that's in a matter of weeks that those flights will go up by 20%. So I think we can safely say that if we are looking at price increases, we can look to what the US are doing and safely say that we could be looking at anything up to 20% here.
Siobhan, during the pandemic, cancelled flights led to many customers demanding refunds from airlines, but in many cases, they only got flight vouchers instead of the cold hard cash. Has this issue been resolved, or are you getting any indication from what you're hearing? Is there a risk of something similar happening again, where we see rising COVID cases, possible restrictions coming down the line again? What are you hearing in this regard?
Yeah, so this is an interesting one because, you know, if you just scan the news pages even today, and we see that the rates of COVID cases are rising across so many countries at the moment. So will this have a knock-on effect on travel? Absolutely, if any of those countries go into lockdown. So for the consumer expecting to fly off to a destination that suddenly goes into lockdown, and if the flight is still going, which means the flight isn't cancelled, but you can't travel there yourself, there's a real difficulty in getting your money back. And we've had that in the last year with all our airlines in terms of consumers trying to get their money back being fobbed off with vouchers. So yeah, there's a concerted effort now among 16 airlines in the EU to try and pay back customers some of the money that they didn't receive in terms of cancelled flights last year. Mm-hmm. But I do think that for the consumer, they have to remember that they don't have to be fobbed off by vouchers, that you have a right to a refund and you can stand your ground. We do have a situation at the moment where some consumers are saying that they're being asked to repay money they got back in chargebacks by Ryanair at the moment. But your consumer rights are that you are entitled to a refund.
Okay. Siobhan Maguire, consumer journalist, will have to leave it there on Morning Ireland. Thank you very much for your time this morning.